The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis Podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
It is my great pleasure to be joined today by Dr. Nathan Fayard, an assistant professor of English at Indiana Wesleyan University. He specialises in Old English literature, medievalism and the Inklings, and he's recently authored a new book called The Recovered Images. We're going to be talking about Nathan's work, as well as sharing a paper that he presented at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University in Oregon. And the title of Nathan's paper there was Prometheus on Perelandra, the Inversion of the Satanic Hero. Would you be able to describe, let's have a chat about some of those romantic ideas. Would you be able to describe the concept of a romantic hero?
Yes. So just like with the dates around romanticism, there have been oceans of ink spilled about how we define romanticism. And Lewis himself actually takes part in this. So Lewis, in sort of an obscure place, it's in the preface, it's in one of the prefaces, not all the prefaces, one of the prefaces to Pilgrim's Regress, his sequel to John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. Lewis says, what do we mean when we say romanticism? Because I use that concept in the story. Well, we mean so many different things that's basically meaningless, and I'm not going to use it anymore, which he then goes on to use it all the time. But he gives seven different definitions. I'm not going to get into all that. But the point is that there's contention about this for our purposes. We're speaking in generalities and conveniences here. So the romantic hero is a figure that... it's not like, doesn't have its origin in the Romantic era, but becomes very popular in that time. And these are characters who reflect the values of Romanticism. So they are deeply imaginative. They have a great capacity and a great willingness to seek truth through their own intuition and through their own imagination, rather than through outside reason and concrete logic. Which is not to say they discard these things, but they prioritize internal a path to truth rather than an objective tradition or logic-based path to truth. They often have very profound connections to nature and appreciation for the natural world and natural beauty. And they tend to be focused on their own, because they have that focus on the internal path to truth, they often are rebellious figures because they're following their own light as opposed to what society dictates. And in sort of the most intense version of this trope, the Byronic or satanic hero. These are characters who look like Milton Satan, these very grand people who are creatures of will, who are unbowed against all comers and who pursue their own beliefs in the face of everything else, often to tragic ends. And they often sort of struggle with these things. But they are sort of these celebrations of the unbowed will, as Milton Satan himself was read by the Romantics. People like Blake and like Shelley look back and Blake, his whole point is we like this kind of figure. We love this kind of figure. He's really attractive, but he's also really destructive. Mm-hmm. And if we follow him through Paradise Lost, that's what we discover is that Satan is ultimately revealed to be hollow and the grandeur is actually revealed to be just an illusion. And Lewis in Preface to Paradise Lost talks about this, that the romantic hero, the love of this kind of character, this love of this very selfish, very prideful type of character is we are attracted to this because we want that for ourselves. We want to be in charge. But if we are, we find that the God we've placed on the throne of our heart is ultimately just as empty as Milton Satan.
How does the character of Elwyn Ransom fit into this? Because he wouldn't necessarily fit the archetypal romantic hero, would he?
And Lewis, in fact, intentionally designs him to be very unromantic. He's a middle-aged academic. As a middle-aged academic, I tell you, we're not the most dashing and swashbuckling of characters. Or at least, like, you know, speaking for myself. But yet, he possesses a lot of these characteristics, right? He possesses the deep emotional capacity, especially the capacity for love, that's one of the most ameliorating and most noble characteristics of the romantic hero at its best. and he possesses the love of nature and the receptivity to nature. Whenever we stop and admire the beauty of Malakand or the beauty of Pearland or even some of the strangeness in that hideous strength, although Ransom is a secondary character there, we're often doing it, and for the first two books, always doing it through Ransom's eyes. It's the beauty of the Martian tundra and the jewel-like color of the waves in Paralandra. He sees these things, he's moved by them. And because he has this emotional capacity and this emotional connection, he's able to then, and this imaginative capacity, he's able to climb through these beauties to their connection to the divine and to what they mean in addition to what they are. And so he has about half of what makes a romantic hero. But then Lewis does something very interesting. He splits off the other characteristics and gives them to his villain, Weston, and especially when he becomes the unman, when he becomes the demon, he has some of these capacities as well. Weston presents himself as the romantic hero, the champion against the world, the unbowed man of will and vision. And he sees himself in that role, very much the romantic hero. And he has the imaginative capacity, he doesn't have the capacity for love, which is one of the big differences. Lewis tends to give the positive elements to Ransom and the negative, the destructive, the corrosive to Weston.
You've been talking there about Paralandra, and obviously your paper is specifically on Paralandra, but do you see any other obvious parallels in Lewis's other work where he draws on some of these romantic ideas and some of the writing of the romantic period?
Absolutely. Lewis has been called a modern day romantic, and he himself talks about being very attracted to romanticism, and he says that romanticism is at its best spilled with religion. It's these extra touches of the divine that we recognize in our world, that enchant and enrich our world. And romanticism is sort of the capacity of recognizing this. So his work is rich with the kind of imaginative depth and the ability to climb that ladder of perception, seeing the world and recognizing it meaning more than it seems to, that it suggests more than its physical reality is. We see it in Narnia, we see it in the Ransom trilogy, we see it in The Great Divorce, we see it's suffused through his work. And he talks about these ideas in much of his nonfiction as well. The Weight of Glory, one of my favorite of his essays, of his sermons, specifically references Wordsworth, one of the great romantic poets, and says, like, when the romantics are talking about what moves them in nature and what moves them in the world, when they are looking with the eyes of imagination and seeing the world enriched, what they're actually seeing is this longing, this Sehnsucht that he talks about in Surprised by Joy, the glimpses of the divine that are shining through those drops of spilled religion that enchant the world around them.
Nathan, we've already talked about the fact that Lewis is still so relevant to your students, even 60-odd years after his death. I mean, what is it about some of, A, the romantic writers, but also Lewis, that has ensured this enduring legacy long after their deaths?
Well, I actually just taught a class on British Romanticism last semester, and so I saw my students wrestling with this and connecting to this. I think that one of the key things that keeps them relevant and that keeps their work relevant is their capacity to get us to stop and to see the world around us and to recognize its beauties and to realize that beauty means something for us. So just as Ransom on Malakandra sees, oh, this is a beautiful world, and it's not the nightmare that I expected, and maybe that's saying something about who created it and sort of what the architecture of the universe actually is. The Romantics are doing the same kind of thing. They're encouraging us outside my window here. I see sort of gray skies and bare trees. The Romantics encourage us to look at the world in its beauty, but also in its quotidian, everyday costume, and recognize that there is magic in it and there is wonder in it, and that these things, once again, are more than the sum of their parts. It's my window is a bare tree that, you know, just looks pretty bleak, but Coleridge or Wordsworth or Blake might look at it and say, but yes, it suggests though the spring that will come, and it suggests it sort of turns us inward, and it turns us hopefully upward as we look at our world and see the wonder that it has for us.
So really, it's a lot of Brits looking out the window, seeing how terrible the weather is and trying to make the best of a bad situation.
Something that we can definitely connect with here in the Midwest in the winter.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation.
So Nathan, you do this every day, I would imagine, with your students, but how do we ensure that their work, the Romantics and Lewis and Tolkien and some of the other Inklings that you teach about, how do we ensure that their work remains accessible and relevant to a modern audience who, as you've said previously, perhaps don't get all of those references as they're reading it? But how do we make sure that actually we are keeping their work accessible and relevant?
It's a great question. I think what you're doing is a great start.
Right back at you.
Yeah, well, thank you. So I'm teaching at a small liberal arts college, and I think that something that the Inklings recognized was the value of this kind of training. And Lewis himself, you know, he talks in Surprise by Joy about he encounters the Romantics and he doesn't really get all of it at first. And it's, you know, when he then studies with the great Nock and when he goes on to get his degree, these stories that were opaque to him that he didn't find a way into are opened, and then he's able to find the beauty and find their meaning. Instruction is really helpful, and especially because our world is so busy and so packed, and we are so overwrought and constantly running and constantly rushing. And students are often really hesitant to, like, why am I reading this thing that was written before I was born, before my great grandfather was born? Why is this worth my time? And so one of the things that this kind of education allows us to do is to make the case. Here's what this can do for you. Here's what this can do to you and through you. Here's how this can enrich your life and how then you can enrich the world, and how all of this connects us to God and what we're supposed to be doing. And the giving students the opportunity, but also sort of forcing them to take the opportunity to slow down and to read these things and to read them with help. I always tell my students, I don't expect you to understand everything. I expect you to read it and to come to class, and then we'll explore it together and discover it together. And that's what this is for. Because when you're stepping into a text written a century or two centuries or a millennia before you were born, it is difficult. And it's helpful to have guides. And it's helpful to have aides, as Lewis himself did. And now Lewis can help serve that purpose for us. And one of the ways his fiction does that is it then points us to older stories and older traditions and says, don't forget what we've been, don't forget what we've known. The past is not blank for us. It's a rich country that can reward us if we visit it.
We're going to hear your paper really shortly, but just one more clarification before we dive into listening to your paper. You mentioned Byron's Manfred in your paper. Would you just tell us very briefly who Lord Byron was, who his character Manfred was, and why is he noteworthy? Why are you mentioning him?
Very good. And actually, you reminded me, I need to add another piece to the end of this. But Byron, to describe who Byron was briefly is a Herculean task, but I think it's okay. I think it's best summed up by what one of his frenemies said of him, which is that he's mad, bad, and dangerous to know. He was the great popular romantic poet of that era. He was the rock star of all rock stars in the early 19th century. And he was, like a rock star, a source of constant scandal and of constant sort of social turmoil, and was himself a very attractive and a very divisive figure. A lot like the satanic hero or the Byronic hero who comes to share his name, because Byron models several of his characters on himself. Sort of this lionization of self, this lionization of the rebel spirit. His Manfred is the great text that does that, or one of the two great texts, that and his Cain, which is about Cain of the Bible and the rebel against God and sort of he's reinterpreting in interesting and sort of troubling ways. Manfred is about a magician who has achieved great power and great wisdom, but who in the course of that has lost something that's very precious to him, his lover, who may also have other connections to him. It's unclear, and has connections to his biography, which are interesting and troubling. But the key piece is that he's this sort of paragon of the unbowed will, this champion of self as judge of right and wrong and judge of self. You know, God can't judge me, only I can judge myself. I am greater than all else. And sort of the satanic hero taken to its extreme in the Romantic era. And so Prometheus Unbound and Manfred are these two texts that are doing similar things in very different ways. The Rebel Against God, whereas Shelley's is a very joyful, loving version of this, Byron's is a dark and conflicted version of this. But together they are pretty effective. They are the kinds of things that Lewis is thinking about, I think, when he's doing this reworking, because these are characters that are very attractive and we do tend to sympathize with and empathize with. Even Manfred in all his brokenness, there's a nobility in his spirit that is tremendously seductive. So Lewis builds Weston as sort of a reflection of that, but then also draws on what Shelley is doing with his great godless great dance at the end, where the throne of heaven is empty and now all of creation can be equal. And Lewis reinscribes the romantic hero, splitting it between Weston and Ransom. But he also reinscribes that great dance of Shelley's and says, because Weston is after the kind of thing that Prometheus is after as well, a godless universal universe where man is elevated to the throne. And he says, okay, that doesn't work. And we see in Weston and the Unman that doesn't work, that if we take God out, that something else takes his place, something worse, something darker, something destructive. But the actual restoration, the actual felicity that Shelley imagines, that shows up at the end of Perelandra. After Weston defeats after Ransom defeats the Unman, defeats this demonic presence that's haunting the world, he climbs up into the fixed land, this island on Perelandra, and he witnesses and takes part in this immense visionary journey where he sees the universe in all of its complexity and all of its unity. And so Lewis is adapting all the same images that Shelley uses, its circles and wheels and these all this natural imagery, this image of the dance that both of them are drawing from Dante and from the medievals. But if you look at them side by side, they're doing really similar things. But whereas Shelley's is, it's all on the same level. There's no God. It's all us. We're all part of, you know, we're the only judge. We're the only perspective. Lewis is saying, yes, we are not special. Humanity is not special. We are part of everything. But also the reason that it's all worthwhile is because God is there and in the center of everything. And it's this image of the sort of Gordian knot complexity, this image that can't be untangled. Every time you look at it, you see just a piece of it. You can't take in the whole thing because it's so complex and it's so grand. But each time you do stop and see, you see, okay, humanity is central. No, the Balconians are central. No, the Perelandrians are central. But what's really central is in each of these places is God. And he's who gives it meaning. He's who gives it order. And he's who creates order out of all this complexity and all this chaos. And so Lewis takes a vision of universal restoration that is explicitly sort of a-Christian, if not anti-Christian, and reinscribes it, sort of rebaptizes it, and says, we can gain greater understanding of our world and can take ourselves out of the center of it and become part of creation rather than lords over creation. But we need to understand that all of these things matter, all of things mean what they mean, only because the Creator has endowed them with meaning.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.